dare not handle. She'll hold up a candle. She's gonna shine, shine, shine a light of truth on you. She's the weapon of mass instruction.
Good morning, world. Maria Heller here, alive and kicking in the high country of Arizona. We have a few problems with our service today, so be patient, because I can tell you I have a terrific show with Kitty Kelly coming up, and it is pre-recorded. So if you have any questions or anything on what we discuss, send me an email and I'll forward it to Kitty. She was kind enough to make that offer. So I thought, since we're going to be talking about you-know-who, here's an appropriate song by the Compassionate Conservatives, Fret Boy. Bring them on, and bring them on is what I'm going to do with my interview with Kitty Kelly. I pre-recorded it this morning, and it's excellent, so I'm going to ask you to stay tuned because you're going to love it. So here's the interview. So I say, stay with me. What a day. Okay, here I am. Let me tell you about my guest today. A lot of you have been waiting with bated breath for today's interview. I have Kitty Kelly with me. She's the internationally acclaimed best-selling author of Jackie O, Liz Taylor, The Last Star, His Way, the unauthorized biography of Frank Sinatra, Nancy Reagan, the unauthorized biography, and The Royals. But today we're going to be talking to her about her most excellent book, as they say, The Family, the real story of the Bush dynasty. And I can tell you this, that if you think you've read every Bush book out there and know all there is to know, you have to read Kitty's book. It's the absolute best. So without going any further, let me say good morning to my guest, Kitty Kelly. Good morning, Kitty.
Good morning, Maria.
How are you today?
Well, I'm all right. Holding up in August. Holding up.
Well, that's good. I think I should preface the show by saying that you're in friendly waters today. There'll be no attacks on Kitty Kelly here.
I'm not used to that, Maria.
I know you're not, but hey, today you're in the friendliest water you can be in. You know, years ago, Jim Hatfield came out with a book called Fortunate Son, and a lot of people really questioned and denigrated him for the things that he exposed in that book about the Bush family. And then, you know, all these years later, you come out with your book, The Family. And it pretty much verifies everything Jim had in his book so many years ago.
That was a very interesting case on Hatfield when that book came out. It was quite scandalous and eye-opening. And the thing that sunk him, I think, was when it was leaked, and it has been suggested that Karl Rove might have leaked it, that there were, I forget what it was Hatfield a... Wasn't there a death that he was associated with or something that immediately chopped his credibility?
Well, that's a typical move of the Bush family. It's sort of like, you know, what the Republicans are trying to do to Cindy Sheehan down in Texas now.
She has really started quite a peace vigil that almost throws you back to the 1960s and the Vietnam War, doesn't it?
Well, I'll tell you, I've been waiting to see when it was going to happen. You know, I'm like, okay, who's going to be the face of the anti-war movement this time?
It's so very, very hard to ever say anything against a parent who's lost a son or daughter in combat, and that's probably where she gets her moral authority.
Oh, absolutely. I could tell you that, you know, I think I would be a lot more, I'd probably be a lot more psychotic in my little demonstration than she is.
There's nothing worse, really, for a parent than to lose a child, to have to bury a child. But this war has stirred up so many emotions, and not just people who are against the war and for the warriors. I mean, this is stirring up, you know, going back to 9/11. We truly, as a country, after that trauma, I think really wanted to give the president, whether we were Democrat or Republican, our absolute full support. And it appears that he really took unfair advantage and marched us into a war in Iraq that now we're almost forced to support in a way, because we've wrecked the country and we feel like we have to make some kind of amends.
Right. You know, I was curious to ask you, has your book started doing better? Are you getting a little bit more respect now after the war has been going on for a couple of years?
No, I think that the Bush spin machine was very, very effective when the book came out, and they were able to polarize the country. Even polarized my own family, I have to tell you. When my sister gave me a book party, her husband would not attend. That's how polarizing the red and blue states have become, that kind of mentality. And my sister kept saying to her husband, but she's my sister, I want to support the book, I want to support Kitty. He said, I won't attend. She said, would you at least read the book and talk to Kitty about it? No.
Right. Now, do you find that the people that tend to rip the book apart the most are the ones that haven't even read it?
Yeah.
I mean, isn't that crazy?
Well, it is and it isn't, because they're taking their marching orders and forming their opinions on what the White House told them. And these are staunch Republicans. They believe in the president. And that's how they form their opinion of the book. And let's face it, it's a 750-page, well, not quite 700.
It's a big one. I can tell you that mine started falling apart as I was reading it, because I dragged it with me everywhere.
Yeah, it's a big book. So it's, you know, you've got to read at least 100 pages before you can form an opinion.
Right. Well, you know, there's so much that I want to talk to you about that. But, you know, it's a curious thing that we're talking about now, because I wonder, do you think it's fear or loyalty to George Bush that makes people feel that way?
I think it's a little of both, and I think that it stems from 9/11. I truly do. This country was so traumatized that we really wanted to give our support to our president. Then we wanted to exact revenge for the terrorism that was exacted on this country. And we're still feeling it in our economy, in our airlines. We lost over 3,000 lives. It decimated certain businesses. So there was a part of the American psyche that really wanted revenge. And when the president said that we were going to go after the Taliban, of course you said yes.
Right.
Of course you were behind him 100%.
Mm-hmm.
Get them. Well, instead of concentrating on the Taliban in Afghanistan, we went into this war of choice in Iraq. And what was so frightening about it is that you couldn't say no, really. You couldn't say, hold on a second, because it seemed unpatriotic.
Right, well, we were instantly demonized and called un-American to speak out against the president.
Very, very powerful.
Mm-hmm.
Very powerful. And if you realize that, you know, 9 out of 10 people don't want a confrontation, they want to go along, they don't want to step outside the lines, it's like coloring outside the lines.
Mm-hmm.
People fell into line on this. And to stand up and say anything contrary to it makes you a real target at a time when nerve endings are hypersensitive.
Right.
And now we are in such a mess that the majority of the country is not behind the president anymore, because I think that the more information that's coming out shows that there was not enough thought put into this move into Iraq.
Right, and
no way that we're going to be able to establish democracy as we know it. And I think there's a bit of resentment on the part of people who gave their hearts and souls and those that gave their lives, that we don't really know what we were dealing with in Iraq. We did not know that the democracy that we said we wanted to erect there couldn't be done because of the religious components within the country.
Right. Well, there were people that knew that this wasn't going to work. But, of course, you know, the president and his all his little men certainly didn't want to hear it. Kitty, I want to read something that your publicist sent me, because this is just, I mean, I've read it in your book, and I've read a lot of it in your book, but it just blew my mind, and I just want to read this so my listeners can understand where we're going. The pressure the White House put on mainstream media to either ignore or trash Kitty Kelly and her book. Not every media outlet was cowed or influenced, but many key players like Newsweek, The Today Show, Meet the Press, Larry King Live were. Kelly was even fired from The Washingtonian after almost 30 years as a respected contributing editor because of pressure from the Bush camp. And that the Republican National Committee and Republican attack dogs tried to stop publication of her book. Did you actually get fired because of this book?
Yeah, I did. I have been a contributing editor to the Washingtonian magazine for 30 years, and I was taken off the masthead. And when I asked the editor why, he said, because of the Bush book. And I said, well, I don't understand. And he said, you wrote too revealingly about the president and his personal life and the Bushes. And I said, come on, Jack, what are you talking about? It's a biography. And then it hit me. The owner of the magazine is a Bush appointee. His name is Philip Merrill, and he is president of the Export-Import Bank, and he's very close to Dick Cheney, a personal friend of George Herbert Walker Bush, mm-hmm. and now a presidential appointee. So I didn't even argue any further. It was, that's what it was.
Right. Did you think that this was even a possibility when you started writing the book?
Not that. There were two things that happened. After the book came out and there was all the controversy, Maria, if you had told me that living in Washington, D.C., I would experience any kind of partisan blowback, I'd say, no, not possible. It's a very diverse city. It's predominantly Democratic, but it's just not that way. Well, was I stupid and naive. I not only lost my job on the Washingtonian masthead, but I also was asked not to take part in a benefit for the Arena Stage in Washington, D.C. Now, I point those two things out because the whiff of McCarthyism, while you might expect it in certain areas, you would never expect it in the media or in the arts. And that's what I found very, very frightening. I mean,
well, unfortunately, a lot of writers are being, are being censored by publishing houses. It seems that, you know, a lot of the really good writers can't get their publishers to put their books out, even if they've done their books before.
I don't know about that. I do think that publishing is always in a state of turmoil, and they're always trying to second guess what will be successful. When a writer signs with a publisher, you sign, like, you know, 3 years before your book's to come out, 4 years sometimes.
Right.
And so a publisher doesn't exactly know where to make their investments. But it is quite true that that kind of censorship, people are afraid to be on the wrong side. It's like during the 1950s when people started whispering in elevators.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't think it would get that bad. I really didn't. And I was wrong. Now, the fact that I was taken off the masthead of the Washingtonian certainly hasn't hurt me economically. But it was frightening nevertheless, because it told me something about what's happening in the country.
Right.
And it's happening in a city where it's the nation's capital.
And it's very scary days for our democracy, as we, you know, say we're bringing democracy elsewhere. We're losing our rights left and right. But that's a story for another day. Let's get over to your book, Kitty. And again, Kitty Kelly is who I'm speaking with. Her excellent book, The Family, The Real Story of the Bush Dynasty, is here, available on my book list. It's a must for your library. There is no option but to own and read this book. Kitty, I have to say, with all the things that I read about the Bush family from, you know, Prescott Bush and all the rest, blah, 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 you're the only person that really showed me that Prescott Bush really had a lot of good qualities that neither his son nor his grandson seemed to have inherited.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think Prescott Bush, the grandfather of the current president, is probably the most principled member of the political side of the Bushes. I think what was so maddening to the mainstream media about this book wasn't, you know, revelation on page after page. It was the accumulation of detail that they had neglected or overlooked or didn't think was important about the first George Bush. The portrait that comes across in this book about George Herbert Walker Bush is really quite unsettling.
Oh, I agree.
It was unsettling to me. I thought, I started out writing this book thinking that the old man was a decent man,
mm-hmm.
a good man, and I ended up realizing that he was as right-wing and amoral as politicians can be.
Right, well, and he certainly didn't care for you or your book, that's for sure.
He didn't, and you know, what was so strange, and it's contained in the afterword. People should buy the paperback because it's a lot less expensive and it's up to date.
Right, well, that's the one I have.
In the afterword, there is, I thought, a marvelous story about when the book came out. A reporter in Providence, Rhode Island, wrote a book review, and he said he just couldn't believe himself, but he really loved the book. It was dishy and juicy and eye-opening. He said, but at one point, I really took issue with Kelly in the way that she had described George Herbert Walker Bush and his war record during World War II, and he proceeded to tell the reader what he found about Bush. And so he sent his book review on the family to George Herbert Walker Bush, and George Herbert Walker Bush wrote the guy back in hand and said, Kitty Kelly is a liar and a smear artist, and this is why. She says that I made these comments in a book called Man of Integrity. I never heard of the book. Well, the guy then called my publisher and said, this is quite egregious that you would let this go through. And they said, George Herbert Walker Bush wrote the book called Man of Integrity. And the reporter said, no, it couldn't be possible. So they sent him a copy of the book, and the guy calls George Herbert Walker Bush, and his secretary takes the call and says, oh, gee, he feels kind of guilty. He forgot that he wrote that book.
Right. Now, come on. I mean, Kitty, you've written several books. Have you forgotten? If somebody said to you, Kitty, didn't you write that book about Liz Taylor, would you say, wait a minute, let me think?
No, I'd say, yeah, I did write it. I don't remember everything I wrote in it.
Right.
But this was quite something. I was fully prepared to give George Bush Sr. his full marks as a war hero in World War II. After all, he was the youngest guy in the Navy to, he enrolled right after high school. He put aside his college for a while to go off and serve the country, and he also was a great Navy bomber. So I thought, this is a perfect opportunity to really pat this guy on the back. And the contrast between him and his son, who avoided duty, was interesting. Well, during George Bush's service in World War II, the two men that he was flying with lost their lives, and George was able to bail out. And he, up until he was running for president, had always told the same story. And then he wrote this rather smarmy book called Man of Integrity to sort of plump himself up as a war hero, and he changed his story, which was the only reason that I took notice of it. It was in his words, and comparing what he'd said in the 1940s to what he said in the 1990s was quite startling.
Right. Well, the Bush family does have a history of doing revision history, that's for sure.
But you know something, Maria? I didn't know this when I started out. I come from one of those Prescott Bush Republican families. My father, God rest his soul, just died a couple of years ago at the age of 98, and he gave money to both Bush presidential campaigns. So it isn't like I'm a red diaper baby or that I come from, you know, a real liberal democratic background. So I was quite surprised to find out what I found out about the Bushes. And what it told me, I mean, the New York Times said that this is a story of power and sex and betrayal, but mostly of power. And it told me something I guess I really didn't want to know about the American class system.
Right. Well, a lot of people don't want to admit that we have a class system.
That's right. We don't want to admit it because it's shameful in this country.
I agree. I totally agree. Well, Kitty, let's move on to one of the juiciest stories, which really blew my mind. You know, and I mean, I have to tell you, I wrote wowee in a lot of the columns of the book. So I'm going to hit on some of the wowee parts of the book. Bill Clinton. I was never a big fan of Bill Clinton's, but one thing I can tell you is if I would have gotten to hear the word Monica Lewinsky one more time, I think I would have lost my lunch, okay? When you look at how demonized he was for consensual sex with another adult, which who really cares in the scope of things, and then I'm reading your book, and I learn the name Jennifer Fitzgerald, amongst many names of female consorts of George Herbert Walker Bush. I have to tell you that the hypocrisy was more than I could take, and I couldn't understand why was it that Clinton never used that while he was being demonized.
There are a couple of reasons. One, Barbara Bush. Barbara Bush has been a bulwark of respectability. That white hair, that pre-strand of pearls, the fact that she is a mother and a grandmother, and she has that wonderful matronly image, allowed her husband to carry on with other women with almost total immunity. Jennifer Fitzgerald was on the federal payroll. Monica Lewinsky really wasn't on the federal payroll at the instigation of Bill Clinton. But Jennifer Fitzgerald was for 25, 30 years. She worked for him when he was vice president. She worked for him as president. He appointed her to the second highest position in the State Department in protocol. But no one ever wrote about it, really, because he didn't look like the kind of guy who would screw around on his wife.
Right.
It's just that simple.
Well, it kind of reminds me of the profile of a child molester. There isn't one.
Well, also, again, going back to the class system, George Bush Sr. just seemed to be too nice a guy to do something like that. And after all, look at his wife and all those children and those scampering grandchildren. Whereas Bill Clinton didn't quite look that way, and he didn't have the good public image going for him because he had had a reputation as a womanizer.
Uh-huh. Well, it just seems to me as the ultimate hypocrisy when you see what, you know, the spin machine did to Clinton and the fact
what the spin machine did, but you also have to take the mainstream media to task on this. Had they done their job properly over time?
Oh, absolutely not. I mean, if you read, you know, and of course you cover it in depth, and I want people to know, you probably have more information on Prescott Bush in your book than anybody's book I've ever seen. So it was a good education for me.
I know, but Maria, there are probably people out there saying, okay, Prescott, who cares?
Because that's where it really starts. And, you know, when you look at it, you know, I have to tell you, Kitty, I'm new to the news because it's not my, believe me, it was never my preference to deal with the news 24 hours a day. But I said to myself, how could it be that George Bush Sr. and Jr. both ran for president and none of us knew about his family history? With supporting the Nazis, with all that, you know, the fact that, you know, their companies were brought down by our own government for trading with the enemy. If Americans would have known what Prescott Bush and the rest of them were up to, and we were told the truth, I don't think any Bush member would ever have been elected to office. And yet the press seemed to have kept those secrets pretty good.
Well, they liked the Bushes, and they were impressed by the Bushes' social status. And they were, they thought they were dealing with a really blue ribbon family here. And I stress the word family because without that family background, neither Bush could have been elected to public office. It's an interesting dynasty because the money part of the Bush is the Walkers. And they're the ones who started out in St. Louis with all the money, and the Bush side of it went into what they call public service and the rest of us call politics. And you can't have one without the other. You've got to have the money in order to get elected. But the Bushes were able to keep one part of the family working the money machine and the other part of the family being out front. Nothing wrong with that. Absolutely nothing wrong with it. The Kennedys did it. The Rockefellers did it. The Tafts did it. I just happened to write about the Bush dynasty, and I found it absolutely fascinating.
Mm-hmm. Right. And they, for some reason, want to, you know, constantly argue against the fact that they are a dynasty.
Right, because there's something very elitist about that word, and they know it. And it is not elitism that gets you elected.
Right. Right, exactly.
But I do think it is family that gets you elected. And I mean that in a couple of ways. We now know the absolute potency of family values. And this is a family that espouses family values. And goodness and decency and God-fearing. As Barbara Bush said, we gave our papers in the presidential library to Texas A&M because we believed in their conservative, religious, militaristic values. Well, that's fine, but if you're going to make that kind of a statement, you've got to make sure that you're walking the walk. And I was quite surprised when I had that sit-down interview with Sharon Bush, and she went on at great length about this family and about George Bush's mistresses and about George W. Bush's drug use and about her own husband. And at first I thought, well, I'm just talking to a hysterical wife here who's bitter. He's divorcing her, so she's just taking off after the family. But I really did, as hysterical as she was, I did check out her stuff, and she checked out on absolutely everything. So as she said to me, is this family values?
Right. Well, obviously, their family values is for everyone else.
But you know something, Maria? When the book came out, Sharon Bush got so frightened because of the power of this family that she really backed off her interview. She categorically denied everything. And I would have been lost had it not been for the fact that somebody witnessed all of our interviews. And thank God they did, because I, like a fool, didn't tape them.
Ah, that is a good thing. Well, I mean, you know, here's a family that, you know, obviously threatens everybody that comes in their way. I mean, you know, we've all heard, you know, the standard stories of the revengeful nature of George Jr.
Well, you know something, Maria? You don't even have to be... You just have to hear a couple of those stories, and then you start, I say you generically, start assuming the fear yourself, and you don't want to step out. You don't want to say anything. You don't want to have, and let's face it, you don't want to have an IRS audit. You don't want to lose your job. You don't want to be socially ostracized. And this is what happens to you if you stand up and say what I've said. I mean, I've suffered it. I haven't gotten the IRS audit yet, but I've been socially ostracized. I got knocked off the masthead of the Washingtonian. I've had people very, very upset by what I wrote, and yet I will tell you, you and I are sitting here in August of 2005. Nobody in the Bush White House or the Bush family has stepped forward yet to say there's one error in the book, one misrepresentation, one inaccuracy. They have not taken issue with the facts, but they hate the fact finder.
Right. Well, that's another typical Bush move. Whenever anything blows up in their face, they just choose to ignore it, or, you know, the old famous, you know, I don't remember line.
Well, I think in this case, what they do is muddy the messenger so they can mangle the message. So let's start out right away and say, oh, this woman who wrote this book, it's just trash. It's just tabloid. It's just gossip. And let that sit on her so that people will be dissuaded
right
to the book. And I do find it absolutely fascinating that they have not found one inaccuracy in the book.
No, and I think you say something similar, that you've never lost a lawsuit yet.
No, I haven't. That's quite right.
So that speaks volumes, Kitty. You know, because if indeed there were any distruths in this, as the Bush family would like the world to believe, you know, I'm sure they would be trying legally to shut it down or shut you down or sue you.
No question.
Right. So, I mean, that's common sense. I wondered, reading your book, if people in other countries, heads of states, say in Iraq, Afghanistan, you know, China, Russia, Japan, if they had read this book, because it's very clear to me as I read the news what other heads of state think about George Bush. How far-reaching is your book? Is it worldwide? Do you know?
Yes, it is. It has been internationally published, and I did do a tour in the UK, in Spain. The book has been published in Italy, it's been published in France, in Spain, in the Netherlands, and the reception over there has been absolutely the opposite from the reception here.
Mm-hmm.
But that's because most of Europe is so against the war in Iraq.
Well, and they also know a lot more facts from their media than we ever get to know here. So I think they're a lot more savvy, too, on what's going on politically worldwide.
And they take a different worldview, of course, than we do. But they also hadn't experienced the kind of terrorism. Spain did, though. It was quite interesting. When I was in Spain promoting the book, they told me how, after that awful hit of terrorism they took, they wanted to dislodge their president, and people got on their cell phones.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a small country. We can't do that here, and we don't have that kind of cohesiveness, because in this country, we really are politically split now. I mean, if you had told me years ago that I'd ever become a one-issue voter, that I'd vote on one issue, I'd say, no, not possible, not possible. But I think I have become that way, and people have become that way. They vote whether you're pro-choice or anti-choice. And that's the one vote that can carry a candidate or sink a candidate.
Right. We vote on the things that aren't important instead of the things that are important.
Well, on choice, I think that one really is important because it does affect people's lives, their economies, gets into their religion. The religion thing is fascinating too, Maria, because when I was doing this book, I was born in the early 19, I was born in 1942. So I remember when church and state were really separate in this country.
Mm-hmm.
And I was too young to really remember much, or too dumb to remember too much of the JFK campaign. But I do remember growing up as a Catholic, having it drummed into me that there was a separation of church and state. And I remember when JFK was running for president, he had to spend the majority of his campaign convincing the American people that he would never let the Catholic Church influence his decisions.
Right.
President.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, look how far we've come, because we now have a president who the very first thing he did when he walked into the White House was set up a faith-based initiative. And he has let his religion influence his policies, and he's been very open about it.
Well, and let's not forget, he talks to God. He's on a mission from God, which is very scary.
Well, it is scary, I guess, if you don't share the same God, or that there are people that are being governed by those policies who don't believe in that God.
Mm-hmm.
But we are supposed to be a country that separates church from state, and we no longer do that anymore. And yet, ironically, that's the very thing that's going to hold this president back from establishing a democracy in Iraq, that he hadn't taken into consideration the three religious sects that are tearing the country apart. And the thing is, there are very few people who would honestly say that they're not sorry to see Saddam Hussein deposed.
Right.
And yet, it's so disconcerting to read the reports that people in Iraq say they're no better off having us there occupying the state, the country, because they can't get electricity, they don't have the basic services that we consider just part of civilized living.
Right. A lot of people say they were better off under Hussein. So you look at that and you say, you know, wow, this is as bad an image as the United States could ever possibly have worldwide. And I can tell you, Kitty, as a real patriot, it really hurts me.
Oh, that's right.
You know, I mean, you know, a lot of people may not even care, you know, everybody with their bumper sticker, you know, support the troops. They have no idea what's really going on. But as a real American,
you support the troops. I support the troops.
Right. Our taxes are supporting the troops.
Well, no, I mean, and emotionally, I'm for the warriors. It's
okay.
Just this war.
Right. Well, right.
War.
Exactly. Kitty, we need to go to a short break. When we get back, I'd like to cover some of what you have about Georgia and Laura, because we've left Laura out of the equation.
Imagine your ad,
stay with us.
Ad right here, right now, in the middle of this great show, going out over to 60 countries and 100,000 listeners and more a month. If you think advertising is out of your reach, it's more reasonable than you think. If you've got a business, a product, a website, or a cause that you'd like to advertise on the Maria Hella Show, email Don at MariaAds@earthlink.net or call 347-405-7216 for more information. They say in good times it pays to advertise, but in hard times, advertising is a must. You'll also know that your advertising dollar goes out to like-minded people interested in supporting people who are supporting their belief system. Partner up with the Maria Hella Show and know that your money is also supporting true independent media. Again, the email is MariaAds@earthlink.net. The phone number is 347 405-7216. Together we're creating a new paradigm and a new community. And now, back to the Maria Heller Show.
Okay, and I'm sure that you're sitting on the edge of your chair listening to this awesome interview with Kitty Kelly, her book, The Family, The Real Story of the Bush Dynasty. And as I said, an absolute must. Kitty, before the little break, I had mentioned George and Laura. Now, you know, a lot of people look at Laura and say, is she from Stepford or what? Could she be for real?
Maria, you know something. It goes back to the public image again. The Bushes know how powerful a public image is. And her public image is so bland and so non-threatening that her poll ratings are much higher than the president himself. And as a matter of fact, when you compare the former first lady we had for 8 years, Hillary Clinton,
right,
to Laura Bush, it is like absolute night and day. Laura Bush is basically a very smart woman, very shrewd, but she has done very little as first lady, and it has served her and her husband well.
Mm-hmm.
Her causes are really causes that were put forward by the first Mrs. Bush. Barbara Bush was a very active first lady, a very positive and constructive first lady. She went out there and spearheaded literacy. This Mrs. Bush has really done very little. She has taken up the cause of Iraqi women and Afghanistan women, which is wonderful, but you almost wish that she'd help American women.
Exactly.
Well,
maybe she can relate better to them, because obviously the Bush family is a real machismo, you know, the man rules kind of family.
Well, that is true. That is absolutely true. The husbands do rule in the family, especially the political husbands.
Yeah, and you make that clear. You know, none of these women work. I mean, they've had no careers. You know, they have to just be, you know, the shadow of their husbands.
You know, Laura Bush was a librarian before she met and married George Bush. Laura was on the rebound from a very sad love affair in Texas. She went home to Midland when the whole thing broke up, and she met George Bush, and they were married within 3 months. And since that time, you're quite right, she has not worked outside of the house. Now, having a family was very, very important to her. And they had to finally go to a fertility clinic because she couldn't get pregnant. So having those twins was very, very important to Laura Bush, and she spent her time as a mother and a housewife. Now, as First Lady, she has done really nothing to offend anyone.
Mm-hmm.
And she's kept a very, very low profile. She spends most of her time shopping, believe it or not.
Right. Well, yeah, that's for sure. And then, you know, I want to read a little paragraph out of your book, if you don't mind. But it's talking about George and Laura, and it seems that when they were younger, a lot of their friends didn't even want to hang with them because they were too wild. You talk about a vacation that they took in Tortola in the British Virgin Islands. And it says, the Bushes used to attend and enjoy heavy pot-smoking parties. This wasn't inconsistent with Laura's past. She graduated from Southern Methodist University in 1968 and has been known in her college days as a go-to girl for dime bags of marijuana. She not only smoked dope, said public relations executive Robert Nash, but she sold dope. So now, you know, I think about that. I think about Sharon Bush saying that George Jr. was, you know, snorting coke at Camp David, which obviously would place him after he was born again. And then the hypocrisy of them when they come out with their war on drugs, or as George does an imitation of his father, just avoids the subject when he's asked about it.
Well, you know something, to his credit, he has never, ever denied his cocaine use, ever. He is too smart to lie about it because there are too many people out there, Maria. So he has said, when I was young, and irresponsible. Now I'm grown up, and I'm mature. And so we give him a pass on that, because there's nobody from that generation who wants to stand up and come down too hard on him. But it is the hypocrisy. And the story, the backstory behind Laura Bush is really the story that's fascinating. But I don't think you can really tell it right now, because it goes against the established public image. It's sort of like, I don't know, it's sort of like the Doris Day, you know, she seems so sweet and so nice and so good and pure, and that to say anything other than that just wouldn't be believable.
Right. Well, it would be, it's less believable to know that these people of our generation could have grown up at a time, you know, through the 60s, et cetera, and not have experienced any of that. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yes, I do know what you're saying.
It was a normal part of our childhood. It was a normal part of coming of age, you know, whether you smoked pot, whether you, you know, took a drink, or, you know, the whole disco scene. And, you know, you have some pretty juicy stories of George, you know, spinning around on the floors drunk. But if you really look at it, Kitty, I mean, I don't know if you have children, but I have children and I have grandchildren. And I look at the produce of this elitist family. All their kids seem to have a lot of problems with using and different things, you know, from Noel Bush to, you know, the twins being nailed for so many different things, Jeb's kids. When you look at, you know, my father used to say, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree.
Well, but we're talking about, as far as the apple falling, on temperament, you're quite right. But on substance abuse, there is a genetic predisposition to alcoholism, to drug abuse.
Right.
And this family does have it. And it starts with Barbara Bush's side, and it's George Bush's side as well. And you see how those genes have come down. And unfortunately, the ones that are really paying for it, I mean, George Bush, the current president, was able to get himself together. So you got to give him full marks on that, not for his hypocrisy.
Right.
Got to give him full marks for getting dry and getting sober.
Right. Well, for a lot of people, a really severe and strict religion is, you know, a good escape for somebody that's been abusing. And I know, you know, from experience with a lot of people.
Yes, you're absolutely right. But the children, like Jeb Bush's daughter, is such a sad story.
Right.
I had not realized until Sharon Bush told me that Noelle is, you know, she's close to 30 years old now, and she's still drug addicted. And that is sad.
Well, yes, of course it is. And, you know, it's not just that. I look at that and I say, well, these kids couldn't have been very happy growing up and families where their parents were never available to them. You know, you can't just look at the genetic part of it. I look at, you know, these people, it looks like they were campaigning all their lives or into, you know, their whites-only clubs and, you know, busy, busy, busy. And it seems to me that these children probably didn't get any of the right attention they needed from their parents.
It's very hard in politics. You are right. And George and Barbara Bush were never there. That's the one thing that does come across. They're always handing their kids over to neighbors, to friends, putting them in boarding schools. When I interviewed the headmasters at St. Albans in Washington, D.C., they said quite openly the Bushes were traveling or socializing all the time, and that's why we got their kids. And I said, would you have taken the kids even if they had bad grades? And they said, of course.
Right. Well, it was really like they, you know, looked like they tried to get rid of them as much as possible. I'm trying to remember if it was when they left Jeb off out of school for, you know, over a year.
Yeah, you're right.
And, you know, you look at that and you think, you know, as a parent, I think, you know, here you got these two little kids, you know, two little boys, and I think about George not even being told when his sister died. And you say, you know, here they are all alone on their own. And you could certainly understand why George Jr. has the problems he has, you know, relating to his father. And yet it seems as though the parents were so self-centered. It was always about them. And it's like they had children like you and I would have pets. Maybe I treat my pets better. I don't know.
No, as far as putting them in kennels and bringing them out when they were home and petting them and liking them when they were around and then putting them back in the kennel when you left town. And the kennels were the private schools.
Right.
You're quite right. And you see that especially. The boys managed to do all right. It's Doral Bush, the one daughter. And she probably showed the effects of it more. She's still very dependent on her parents, although she is married for the second time and she does have children herself. She now, by the way, is going to become a religious minister of some sort.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of following in George W.'s footsteps. The interesting thing that also comes through this book is the family's abysmal record on civil rights.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I was surprised to learn.
To me.
I was surprised to see that Prescott Bush was more of a civil rights person than his son or grandson.
I know it. That surprised me, too. And I was stunned when I found out that George W. Bush kept a Confederate flag plastered to his wall at Andover.
Well,
I don't know why that. And the school did absolutely nothing. And this came to me from one of the two black students who attended Andover with George W. Bush. And he said, I was just terrified to walk into that room.
Well, how many whites-only clubs and properties did they own? You know, I was surprised, you know, that they would, you know, even buy property that has a clause that you can't sell to non-whites.
It is part of that elitist mentality. They probably didn't even think about it. Their excuse when asked is, oh, we didn't know that covenant was in the real estate contract.
Right, and let's not forget the anti-Semitism that you make very clear in the book. You know, the hypocrisy of this family just goes beyond the pale as I'm reading it. And there were two cases, I have to tell you. You know, a lot of authors, I don't know whether you mean to be funny sometimes, but when I can laugh out loud from something on a written page, when you called Neil Bush the Fredo of the Bush family, I cracked up.
I sort of like the quote. Think about the Godfather.
Well, but hey, let's
think about hot-headed Sonny, who's kind of like George W.
Right.
Poor benighted Fredo, who didn't know up from down or what he was doing, and so dependent on the family that,
right,
you know, he's still dependent on his father.
All I know is it cracked me up, and the difference, of course, is, let's face it, the Corleone family was pretty darn good-looking, Kitty.
They were pretty good-looking, and God knows they ate well.
That's for sure. Fredo.
Barbara Bush serves Ritz crackers with Cheese Whiz.
And thinks that that's, you know, hoi polloi. I know it's... We shouldn't laugh, but, you know, your book cracked me up in so many ways. Let me tell you the other story that really the world needs to know, because, you know, everybody wants to believe that Billy Graham was the finger of God that touched George Bush and he became born again and, you know, son of man and, you know, listening to God. But when you tell the story of the Jesus on Wheels, I was cracking up.
That is interesting, isn't it?
And the fact that he doesn't admit to Jesus on Wheels.
No, but you better tell your listeners, because they're not going to understand Jesus on Wheels. It was a fundamentalist preacher who had gone to Midland because the bottom had fallen out of Midland during the oil bust, and morale was so low that the city fathers decided, well, they'd bring this preacher man to sort of shore up everybody's psyche.
Right.
He came to Midland carrying the cross of Jesus on wheels.
Jesus on wheels. I can't stop laughing.
And he pulled it through the streets. He did. And then he had this revival meeting in a great big tent in Midland. And George W. Bush, who was having some real personal problems, drug problems, alcohol problems, and now real financial problems, had lost most of his money. He didn't want to go to the revival because he knew how it would look. But he called two of his friends, and said he'd like to meet the guy who was pulling the Jesus on Wheels through the street. And they met at a coffee shop, and that's when George Bush became born again. And the preacher man wrote into his diary, I brought the son of the vice president to God today.
Right.
And that's real. Now, maybe Billy Graham put the finishing touches on it for George, but that's who really did it. And it is Billy Graham who is the accepted evangelical in the United States who gets the credit.
Right, but people.
And Billy Graham was a friend of the family, no question. Uh-huh. I remember.
Well, look at all the other fanatics, though, that were friends of the family. You know, the people like, you know, Ralph Reed, you know, Jerry Falwell, the rest. And, you know, I remember, you know, my book just opens by itself from all the pages I've earmarked in it, Kitty, where he's giving a speech. George is giving a speech at Bob Jones University in Greenville. And in 2000, the same university's president referred to Mormonism and Catholicism as cults, which call themselves Christian, and that they actually had a placard there that said, "Vote Bush because gay people have too many rights."
Exactly.
I mean, this is the mentality of the money behind a man who, as a member of Skull and Bones, you know, laid down in a coffin and told everybody his sexual experiences.
You know something, Maria? I'm very surprised. You're in Arizona, and John McCain represents the state.
Right. I can't figure out anything about John McCain except maybe he's a Manchurian candidate or got brain damage somewhere along the line that we missed out on.
No, Maria. He seems like he talks sense, and people like his candid manner. But how he ever supported Bush after what Bush did to him and to his wife and to his children in the 2000 South Carolina primary. Yeah. I don't know.
Including, I think he accused them of having had a black baby out of wedlock, which only a white elitist would even think of in the first place.
Exactly, that nasty, nasty racism. And they do play the race card when they have to. His father did it.
Right.
With Willie Horton, and George W. Bush did it.
Exactly. And I said, you know, after how they demonized and tortured John McCain, how can he back? And, you know, he's the first one that came out and said, you know, yesterday, I remember on the news, I reported it, that McCain said he supports Bush in leaving the military option on the table for Iran. And I look at that and I say, how can John McCain, of all people, unless they gave him some kind of lobotomy, support anything George Bush does after what was done to him?
There's only one explanation. And that is ambition, and that his ambition to run for president is such that he had to absolutely exploit his soul to get the support of the right wing. Because if he does not have the right wing behind him in the Republican Party, he will not get the nomination. It's all I can think of.
Well, I don't know. My thoughts were Manchurian candidate, anybody? I mean, I don't know what else makes sense. Yeah, I know you come from a Washingtonian point of view, and I, you know, my mind is still stuck in Brooklyn, you know, where we question everything to death and trust nothing. Kitty, let me ask you this, because we're getting close on time, and I know you have another appointment. Do you see the Bush dynasty continuing in politics? Do you think Jeb Bush is being lined up for 2008?
Jeb Bush says that he is not, and I don't really believe that. The one thing that will keep him from not running is the disintegration of his family. And his wife absolutely hates politics, and he's got a drug-addicted daughter. But he is the one in the family that is really the politician, according to George Herbert Walker Bush. I disagree with it. I think that the current president is a better politician than Jeb Bush. Jeb is a little too wonky and a little too intellectual.
Right. God forbid you be intellectual and be president of the United States.
Right. But you know something? He is so beautifully positioned.
Mm-hmm.
He's got the family name. He's got all the money in the world behind him. He's got the recognition. He has been governor of one of our largest states. He is perfectly positioned to go. Now, I don't know how he's going to withstand the pressure of the GOP when they come to him and say, go.
Right.
But the Bush family right now, amongst themselves and to their closest friends, say that Jeb probably will be president, but not in 2008.
Well, let's hope our country's still here in 2008, and then we'll worry about it.
So, well, it's going to be interesting because the current President Bush's legacy on Iraq will inevitably influence his brother's ambition. The thing is, Jeb Bush is truly, he's even further to the right.
Right.
H.W. Bush is.
Right.
And that's hard.
Well, I remember when they asked him when he was running for governor, I believe, what are you going to do for the black people of the state? And he said, probably nothing.
That's right.
I mean, that's how much more obvious do these people have to be about, you know, being elitist? You know, and they try to be, you know, to show themselves as the everyman, which, of course, they're not.
You know, if you sat down and you did a chart, who has fared best in this country under the Bushes, it would certainly be big business.
Mm-hmm.
But then I suppose you could say that almost about, no, you couldn't. You couldn't. I take that back. I was going to say perhaps you could say it about almost any president.
No, and I say the difference between him and Clinton is, well, Clinton was, you know, reaping in the rewards. He made sure we, the people, got a little bit of what, you know, of the resources, too. And that was the difference. You know, here we have a corporate presidency that, you know, doesn't even want workers to have rights anymore.
That's true.
And it's, you know, it's very sad. And I don't want to be, you know, in a country that's supposed to be a democracy with a president who says that God is telling him what to do. You know, if I wanted to live in a place where people think God is telling them what to do, I'd probably live in Israel. Do you know what I mean? But it's crazy. Kitty, what book, if any, are you going to work on next?
I don't know, but if any of your listeners have a good idea or a great story out there that needs to be told, Maria, tell them to get in touch.
Hey, I certainly will. Hey, you know, I'm not as famous as the rest, but oy, can I give you a story, darling?
All right, well, get on it.
We'll be talking. Kitty Kelly, thank you so very much for your interview today.
Thank you, Maria.
It's been a pleasure. Kitty Kelly, I hope you enjoyed today's interview. I hope you learned something from it. Get her book. It's well worth the read. And also tomorrow, Webster Tarpley's coming on the show with his latest book, 9/11 Synthetic Terror, Made in the USA. You're not going to want to miss that show. It's probably one of the most educational books I've read in a long time. So again, thanks for listening. Thank you for your support.
Maria with an E, the mouth that roared, the Maria Heller Show. Number one show on the net each year because they know that though the mainstream press may be frightened, scared, and cowed, she's not afraid to tell the truth and to tell it loud. When there's a right-wing scandal the others dare not handle, she'll hold up a candle. She's gonna shine, shine, shine light.